what Brooklyn sounds like.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
All right, everyone, welcome back to Brooklyn Free Radio. This is Objection to the Rule. I am Raymond Curtis, and we have here with us as well Violet. Violet, how is everything going?
Hey, everything's good. Good to be back in the studio.
Yeah, I know. After 2 weeks, and it's been a crazy, crazy 2 weeks.
Yeah. Crazy for the government, crazy for us, right?
Yeah.
And it's the first Objection to the Rule of the New Year, so...
Happy New Year, everyone.
Ringing in the New Year with Radio Free Brooklyn.
Are you ready to start crossing out the 8 for the next 3 months and writing a 9 over the top of it?
Yeah, that's definitely what I'm going to do. So today we're going to get into it with the ever-stretching, ever-expanding government shutdown, a new House of Representatives, populism and its discontents in Brazil and in Hungary, and a new twist in the L-Train saga for us here in Brooklyn. How'd your holidays go, Raymond?
My holidays were great. I didn't go anywhere.
Nice.
My husband and I decided to stay home. All the families were doing different things and spouses and stuff like that. We're going different places. So we were like, you know, we're just going to stay here.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to relax. We're going to get our own tree. We're going to get our own presents.
Very nice.
We had our little puppy dog with us. And yeah, for Christmas and New Year's, we were right here in East Williamsburg, living it up. It was great.
Very nice. Very nice. What kind of dog do you guys have?
We have a boxer pit bull, actually. It's the first pit bull that I've ever had, and I have fallen in love. Like,
that's
they
great.
Are the
sweetest
dogs I've ever seen. And I grew up with dogs, so those pit bulls, man, who knew? They look so scary, and then they crawl up on you and smile and cuddle.
Just want to cuddle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went out with my boyfriend and his family down to Miami, so we had a warm, warm Christmas with lots of family together time.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's nice. Let's get right into it with national news. Raymond, what went on this week?
We had, and really over the last couple of weeks that since we're going to be discussing these things, because it's been quite a holiday season for everyone. To begin with, let's just start with the good stuff. The 116th class of Congress broke barriers before members even set foot into Washington. And now Democrats have seized control of the House on Thursday with fresh voices and some new energy as they prepare to take on President Donald Trump. Many of them inspired to run because of his presidency, actually. So longtime Democrat leader Nancy Pelosi of California also made history on Thursday when she won back the Speaker's gavel and reclaimed a title that she had held from 2007 to 2011, the first woman to hold that title, and now the first and second. So the party breakdown in the new House of Representatives is 235 Democrats and 199 Republicans with one unfilled seat. So what we're looking at really is what can we hope to see as we over the next 2 years while the Democrats are at the helm again after 8 years of not having the control of the House. And what changes should we expect in the working dynamics of the three branches now in the federal government? So now that we have Republicans only in two, so we have Republicans in the Senate, we have Republicans in the White House.
Right.
But we have Democrats in the House, and that's a very, very important House to hold. That's the investigative House.
Right.
So they're the ones that are going to start looking into things, and it's going to be interesting to see what they find. We also have the government shutdown that's halted paychecks for hundreds of thousands. I think it's a little over 800,000 federal workers. And it has just began its third week on Saturday with no end in sight. We've got a standoff, which has heavily affected national parks and other operations and threatens to halt payments as varied as food stamps and tax refunds coming up. And this has made Trump's unrealized border wall the focal point of his presidency as he seeks to make good on a signature campaign promise. And Trump told reporters Friday that he wants to reopen the government but is prepared to maintain the shutdown for weeks or even years, he said. I want to make another little addition.
You can't see the face I'm making.
Yeah. It's terrible. He doubled down today on calling an emergency, a national emergency, to get the wall built, to get money for the wall. Seizing property from Americans if he needs to. He is really trying to terrify all of us.
Right.
So, I mean, we want to know, like, what are we What are the two sides of this? I think it's important to lay that out really clearly. Mm-hmm. And who do we expect to break first? I know who I expect. So where should we start? You pick.
Well, I think, you know, the shutdown's prominent on everyone's mind, so maybe we should go in that direction. Two main sides. That's an interesting question. I mean, obviously we have Trump versus the Democrats, but it seems in a lot of ways we also have Trump versus the Republicans, you know?
I wish we would hear more from them. Mm-hmm. I wish we would hear more Republicans speaking out. And I don't remember, there was a governor that just spoke out calling for Trump to make a deal and end the shutdown.
Right.
You know, Democrats in the House have already been coming forward with proposals, and right. they had been before that. In fact, there was a proposal that didn't include wall money, if everyone remembers, mm-hmm. Before the shutdown that passed the House, passed the Senate, and Trump wouldn't sign it. And so we ended up in a situation where it's a stalemate, and Democrats aren't going to allow Trump to waste $5 billion at plus just to make some kind of statement and fulfill some kind of campaign promise that doesn't actually accomplish anything.
Right. And the other side of that is, you know, the era of unchecked power for Trump is over. It's, you know, he still has control of the Senate, but House of Representatives is not going to go his way. And he's going to have to sort of either learn to work with them or sort of dig his heels in even further and alienate himself from Republicans if he wants to keep his agenda going.
I don't think he's going to get much done either if we look at the last 2 years and the progress that he's made. And bear in mind, like, the work that presidents do and the administrations, presidential administrations do, they're frequently don't see results for you know, some time. Like, the understanding that the economy of this like of the first 2 years of a president's presidency
right.
Is really based more off of the work that the previous president had done. If that was the same president, then it's that president's work, but otherwise it's the previous president. But you do see some progress, you do see some change being made, you see some steps forward at least. And we haven't seen any of that. We've seen everything that Trump has tried to do, from DACA to the border wall, trade wars, you know, pulling troops out of Syria, which now they're backtracking on. We're no longer pulling troops out of Syria. It was just some kind of stunt. All of these things that he's trying to do to establish his legacy as a president. And it's all been just one huge failure after another.
Right.
But back to the border wall, I want to also point out, so I lived in Mexico for a few years.
Oh.
And it's when the people on CNN and MSNBC and they talk about how the people who are getting here and staying here illegally aren't doing it across the border. That's mostly asylum seekers that are finding their way to, you know, hike and stretch through the desert, these kinds of things. That's the truth. What we're looking at here are destitute people who are looking to come to America where they can save the lives of their families and themselves.
Right.
And that's what we're really facing. And that's why I still think it's so ironic that, yes, we need border security and we need proper immigration reform, but to demonize and vilify these individuals who are literally running for their lives is just the lowest of lows. I'm wondering how much longer some people are going to be able to stomach it when we continue to see children dying in detention
right.
centers. You know, we continue to see families being tear gassed. It's just treacherous.
Yeah, for sure. It's hard to know how we got to this place in American history where we have a new government in power and we're not even thinking about what the possibilities are for the future. We're just sort of cleaning up the mistakes of the previous 2 years. I think your other question is also a good one.
Who do we think is going to break first?
Who's going to break first?
I can tell you one thing. After watching Nancy Pelosi in that Oval Office just speak to that man like he was a child,
right.
to dismiss the stats that he brought to flaunt in front of the cameras, to just make it appear make it so obvious to everyone that was watching that she was in control
right.
in that room, and then watching her speak, of course, when she was voted to be the speaker, And then, excuse me, and then also watching her speak to the press when she gave press conference and they continue to ask about the border wall funding and what she's going to do, and she just shuts it down. And I love to see leadership take control of situations like that so that we can move on, because even viewers, even their constituents watching, want that to happen. They're like, okay, already, I understand you media want to get clicks on these kinds of things, but let's move past this question now, because I feel like she's been very clear about it. And she got even more clear there. And she said, let me make one thing perfectly clear. We are not doing a wall. We are not giving money for a wall, period. No questions asked. That is it. I'm not answering any more questions about that, because it's a single answer. It's not happening.
That's right. And it's also very interesting to watch Nancy Pelosi come into the position of power as majority leader again. You know, you don't see that many people sort of forced out by party lines and then reemerge. And I would say the Republicans did their darnest to make her name, you know, synonymous with just evil, the root of all evil, similar to Hillary Clinton. But she's back and she's commanding respect again, you know.
And it wasn't easy. She did have to, like, I mean, she worked hard again when we were talking about this, how it was so easy for Speaker Ryan.
Right.
And when it came back to Nancy Pelosi being up again, and you know, Schumer was up for minority leader again, but everyone was like, why is it such a question about Nancy Pelosi? Why is everyone saying, well, I'm not sure about this. I don't know if I want her as a leadership. She represents old leadership, da-da-da-da. When she had a good record before, and she was well on her way to do it again, she had to work her butt off again to get the votes. But she did it, because she understands government. She understands collaborating.
Right.
And she worked with her party, you know, 235 individuals, to get 200 of the votes. 200 of them, including Ocasio-Cortez, who was questioning her at every step of the way, which we also appreciate.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, she's pragmatic and she's realistic.
Yeah. It's really, really. So because of all of that, I think it'll be Trump. I think it'll be the White House that folds first. And we said two sides, but I think there is a middle. There's this little middle child called the GOP in Congress, and they don't know what the hell to do. They're just hoping that this ends soon, because their president is like continuing to ruin the party name.
Right. Yeah. All of this is going to be so interesting to watch over the next few months and potentially the next couple of years. Let's go back for a minute to the House itself.
Lovely.
What we might see over the next 2 years.
Well, let's talk about, I want to really quickly share something that we do see already, because I think it's incredibly powerful. And a lot of people are talking about, I mean, it's got to the point, I've been sharing how there are some things that I am weirdly, and please don't take this the wrong way, but I'm weirdly happy about Trump getting elected, because we have these individuals who were inspired through, you know, despise for Trump, but nevertheless, I'm so happy that they were inspired to run and get elected, because we're sitting here now with, let me read this off, and this is from Ilhan Omar, new congresswoman. You've seen her. She wears her headdress.
That's her hijab. Yeah,
her hijab. In Congress, the first one on the floor, she got the rules changed so that she could wear a headdress. It was really wonderful. But she tweets out, the 116th Congress has so much to be proud of. We've got the first Somalia-American refugee, the first Muslim women, the first indigenous women, the first Palestinian-American, the youngest woman, the youngest person, a record of over 100 women, and the largest ever Black caucus, Hispanic caucus, and progressive caucus in history, all because Trump became the epitome of like the lowest common denominator, and we had been continuing to drive towards that in Congress, and people stood up, regular Americans, intelligent, passionate Americans who want to do the job and not make $1 million off of Americans' backs and get in there and do the job, and they ran and they won, and that's inspiring for me.
It is. It really is. As we've gone further into this Trump presidency, I've been more inclined to understand this ridiculous character under the, you know, sense that he's not so much a person as the epitome of where America's at right now.
Right.
And it's kind of beautiful to see that on the other hand, the response to that is where else America is. You know, we're people who represent the working class. We're people who represent immigrants, who represent religious diversity, and diversity of belief. So, you know, we were talking about Pelosi earlier, and now we're talking about what we'll see in the House with Democrats. I think the real test will be we have this establishment figure again in power representing the Democrats' side, as it were. How are they going to work together, you know? Are they going to let the far left sort of... far left, you know, more left-leaning
Democrats. Further the GOP gets to the right, the further left we seem.
Right. So. Are we going to see factionality, or are we going to see people who are working together pragmatically? And it was nice to see Ocasio-Cortez, you know, stand firm in herself and, you know, wink at everyone and vote for Pelosi. But we need to see that she's not going to compromise and that Pelosi is not going to pull everyone to sort of a blind, you know.
Right.
Center right.
I think they have no reason to. To be honest, the more and more I see of Pelosi, the more I hear her speak, and in her statements, it's become clear that she is very fully aware of how things are changing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good to have someone like her at the helm now. And before, I wasn't so sure. I mean, I'll be honest. I was seeing these new freshmen come into Congress, and I was thinking maybe, obviously we don't need a freshman as Speaker of the House, but maybe right. Someone who's going to bring some new fresh ideas. And I definitely disregarded the possibility that Nancy was going to come with new fresh ideas, and she is. I think we're going to see more conflict than we're used to. I think that the Democrats are going to try and work in a bipartisan way, but what you said, like rational and pragmatic, when we start to face things like $5 billion for steel slats that doesn't even cover, a significant portion right. of the border, that's not pragmatic. That's not rational. So it's not partisanship to say no unequivocally
sure.
to that, you know. And I think we're going to see a lot of that because I think that the Democrats are especially the ones that we have now, have less ties to big money. Or fewer ties to big money, and they're ready to step up to the plate and start pushing back on these things.
Right, and even even in the Democratic establishment leadership, I listened to an interview between Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and a New York Times reporter, where Schumer said, he and Pelosi part of their agenda is elevating and supporting the working class, which is not something that you were hearing as much before, Trump's base really made itself known to the world.
Yeah.
You could say Trump's base, you could say Ocasio-Cortez's base. A lot of it is the same people.
I know.
People who are being, and he said, screwed,
by
the U.S.
One another.
Right.
And pitted against one another.
Right.
That's
so,
what's so terrible.
Yeah, so if you can see populism used as a way to elevate and motivate people who don't have as much of a voice, then we might see some progress. But
yeah, I think we're going to see some investigations. I think
right.
we already are. I love the immediate work. Now, folks, this is what a Congress that is there to get work done mm-hmm. looks like. You show up on day one and you don't start work on day one. You arrive on day one with work you've already been developing,
right.
with bills you're already putting in, with work to remove big money from campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the first policies that are being pushed. The first bills that are going through are removing big money from politics.
Right.
They're going to move to investigate certain situations going on all over with everything having to do with the presidential election and the presidential administration.
Sure.
Of course, they're also moving towards we're moving towards a new Green Deal. We don't have a caucus on that yet or any kind of exploratory committee.
Right, but we're actually talking about
we're talking
it. Right,
about it a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm really thrilled to see this kind of work that's already happening along with what everyone thought would dominate all the time, which mm-hmm. is investigations,
sure.
Fighting back against Trump.
We're working towards a workable government.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it helps that we have like almost 40 more members in the House than than the Republicans. So that I think that it was easy to kind of for Nancy, and she knows the House of Representatives, and so she knows how to navigate the bureaucracy. She knows the institution. She knows who to put in what committees. She knows what committees need to be doing what and how. Where Paul Ryan didn't, he was bass ackwards in there. He didn't know up from down, he just stuck with the president,
And was pulled by, by the radical caucuses.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, yeah, you know, it's exciting. It's a little bit terrifying, as with everything in the government right now, but we'll see what happens. So we're going to take a short music break. We're going to hear a couple of songs, and then we'll be back for international news. Stick with us.
Puerto voy para Mayarín. De Alto Cedro voy para Macané. Llego a Puerto voy para Mayarín. De Alto Cedro voy para Macané. Llego a Puerto voy para Mayarín. Entonces
en el monte mío hay paz y fascinación. Si agosan mi amigo, no tumban el vacilón, vacilón.
Vámonos pa'l monte, pa' Guaraca. Vámonos pa'l monte, que el monte me gusta más.
Welcome back to Objection to the Rule. Now, let's hear some international news. But first, Radio Free Brooklyn is proud to announce that we will be launching an after-school program for local teens this year in 2019 to learn media literacy through media making using a hands-on approach guided by local professionals. If you're interested in participating or donating to this program, please go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/afterschool. And remember, all donations are tax-deductible. Now let's hear a little bit about international news, because the world did not just settle down and wait for the U.S. to get its things sorted out in the new government. Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, is provoking regular comparisons to Trump with his protectionist policies, environmental deregulations for the Amazonian region known as the lungs of the earth, and promises to obliterate protections for the country's indigenous people. Now that he's taken office, Bolsonaro is delivering. He appears to be doing all of this and more, and even faster than anticipated. So, you know, the comparisons aren't too far off. Trump also promised many similar things, and he also hastened to get them rolling as soon as he entered office 2 years ago. You know, we've seen this in action for 2 years now. I'm wondering what we can understand about what Brazil might see based on what we've seen with our own version of this guy.
I've had some problems with the comparison. I get the ignorant. There are just some distinct differences, in my opinion. I think we can expect certain things from the citizens of Brazil in response. And I definitely think we can expect something from the global LGBTQI community.
Yeah.
We are going to see some serious pushbacks. It's the reason that the queer community saw the progress that they did in the time that we did. And not to say it wasn't a ton of work, and very hard, and spanned decades, and we still are dealing with the oppression across all different intersectioning demographics. We are still seeing that, but we made progress, I think, based off of other progressive movements much more rapidly, and I don't think it was necessarily because of the times. I think it was because of our coalition. We allied each other instead of having gay men be one group and lesbian women being another group and bisexuals in another and queer and transgender, everyone in their own separate areas. We unified and we continue to do so, even though people like to make fun of the acronym. And so we're going to see, I think we'll see from them a major, like from us, that is a major pushback across the world, not just in Brazil. There is going to be a solid movement there. And with the populace as well. But this guy brings in his ideology. Trump's not ideological, folks. He's not. He doesn't believe the crap that he's trying to make us believe. He doesn't believe that we are in danger.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He's not ideological. He's a capitalist to the bone. He's branding himself. He knows that he has to keep this promise or it makes him look bad.
Right.
He doesn't give a shit. He doesn't care if you're gay or an immigrant or black or brown. He only cares to the extent at which it makes or loses him money.
Him personally,
yes, right. And his brand. This guy is ideological.
He believes it.
He believes that being queer is wrong. He believes that being gay or lesbian or bisexual is a choice. He believes that transgender people have mental disabilities and they need to be locked up or put to death. These are things that it's a phobia, and when you take this kind of fear into an office, you see worse things happen. I fear for the LGBTQI community in Brazil because of this guy.
Right.
You know, because he will do damage to his own office, to his own party, to himself, just to harm the queer community.
That's right. That's absolutely true. And we've already seen a few bills passed, you know, rolling back protections for LGBT Brazilians, in addition to environmental deregulations with a similar philosophy. You know, he doesn't care and his government don't care what effect this has on the environment as a whole. They've said, you know, just because, you know, the global north and because the quote Western society has destroyed their, you know, their own environments, we don't have to protect it for your sake. You know, we don't have to limit our logging and our industry, our farming for your sake. So it's that kind of philosophy. And that, you know, we were hearing that also with Brexit, and we were hearing it to some extent in the U.S. So it's hard to say what's gonna turn that around other than a huge popular movement.
I think we'll see it, though. I know a number of Brazilians here in New York who are either here for school or work, but they're still citizens of Brazil. They're obviously very unhappy about it.
Right.
Similar to how Americans were globally when Trump was elected, we were having to face these other, you know, the other people around us. Like, say you were in France or in Germany or, you know, Australia or something like that. And people would be like, wow, y'all just elected Trump.
Right.
And we were like, okay, but
it's like, not me.
It's not. I swear to God, yeah. Most of us hate his guts.
Right.
Passionately. Brazilians are that way as well with this individual. And I mean, they don't, but you know, what can they do? There's this popular movement, and he wins the vote and gets elected. They saw it coming.
Right.
And now they're ready to deal with it. I think that a number of them are looking to, another reason why I'm kind of still like seeing the upside of Trump getting elected. Mm-hmm. Look at what we've done in organizing. An organizer now is a completely nationally accepted professional career
right.
path.
Community organizer.
A community yeah. organizer is somebody who should be paid, mm-hmm. somebody who should specialize not just in their community, but also in organizing. And they need to be a professional in this career, in this field. And we've developed that, and we've developed grassroots organizing, and we've developed, you know, crowdfunding in a mm-hmm. way that it hadn't been used before, and the use of social media and
right.
the free resources that we have. And I think the Brazilians are going to be able to take away a lot from that, and hopefully we'll bring it to them.
Right. Yeah, you know, that's a good point. The other thing I wanted to look at is, obviously, you know, we can compare Bolsonaro to Trump as much as we want. Brazil and the U.S. are two very different countries with very different histories and different, you know, standings in the international community for you know, historically colonial reasons. But still, you know, when we think of Brazil, we think of South America. We think of many legacies of dictatorships that seized power and that were replaced by popular movements and often ultimately replaced by other dictatorships. You know, you can say some things about the U.S. regarding that, but how is Brazil going to be different in reacting to this figure than the U.S. has been? How is the movement going to be different?
Well, it's going to be... that's a very good question, to be honest. If you want to like pick a country that is reflective of the United States in terms of just racial diversity and cultural diversity, Brazil would be one of them
mm-hmm.
to make that kind of cross comparison. They are very much like that. So I think that we're going to see a lot of similarities. I think we're going to see, you know, possibly different groups unifying. I don't mm-hmm. know enough about them to know if they'll do the same, take the same paths that we did, where we're developing, you know, the Women's March, when we're developing Black Lives Matter,
right.
And these kinds of movements. But I think that we'll see similar types of responses, honestly.
I mean, when people take to the streets, you know, there's not as much of a narrative of difference there.
Right.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think this sort of brings us nicely into the news from Hungary this week. Thousands of protesters filled the street of Budapest this weekend in Hungary to protest the Prime Minister Viktor Orban's controversial new, quote, slave law, which requires workers to work 400 hours of overtime and allows compensation to be delayed by employers up to 3 years. And the opposition to this law is united in ways that previous protest movements have not been. You know, people have filled the streets before, but we haven't necessarily seen the same people and the sheer numbers of people. So,
people aren't going to that. This is one of the, it's one of the reasons that the shutdown is always so controversial, right, as well. It's like, and it's why anyone who's on the we're not going to agree to what you're trying to agree to, give mm-hmm. us something else. And it's not, it hasn't always been Republicans. Democrats have shut down the government as well.
Right.
But somebody does have to take the responsibility of it, and it's usually pretty clear, like it is now. And so When it comes to people working, people's money, individual impact. So I don't mean economy. I don't mean gas prices. I don't mean Dow dropping. I mean their money that comes into their checking account twice a month or something like that. Once you start to affect that and what they expect, what they live off of, especially in countries and in economies, and we have an economy here where there are plenty of people who live paycheck to paycheck barely, and they supplement it with government, you know, welfare and things. People don't respond well to that. They're not going to do it. They're not going to work those hours. Throw me in jail. I don't care. I'd rather sit in jail and not have to work for free.
Right.
You know?
Right. And yeah, that's absolutely right. And the other side of that is, I think what would keep someone out of the streets is what they have to lose, you know?
Right.
They could lose their jobs. They could lose their livelihoods. Mm-hmm. They could lose their, you know, their whatever, their families. If you're forced to work, you're losing it already, you know?
Forced to work for
it's
free.
It's lost to you.
I mean, it's essentially, you can't say delayed for 3 years. No one is stupid enough to be like, okay, you got it. I'll be back in 3 years for that check.
Right.
All right. See you then.
Right.
No,
and especially if you're watching a destabilization in process. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I'm wondering, like, we can see people in the streets, but in all of these cases, you know, in our own case in Brazil and Hungary, what's the tipping point? What's the point at which the people in the streets actually can claim power and change things in the government? And I'm not sure. You know, we may have to watch it.
It's different for all. And it all comes down to this, I think, in this push. We'll see the people in the streets. We'll see not only this new law that he's made and not produce results that he wanted, but produce the opposite results. And so hopefully what the outcome will be is them changing the law or just repealing it. I'm not sure how their legislative system works, but getting rid of that law. I think, you know, as we continue to, as it continues to stand and people continue to push back, I don't think, it's like you said, without anything to lose, where do they go? They just keep fighting.
Right.
They just keep pushing back. And the defending side will slowly start to dissipate in numbers. Like people will fall out
it
of that movement,
a numbers game.
And they don't want to be a part of this anymore. And they're tired of defending something that they don't know if they necessarily even believe in anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a numbers game. And eventually, there is either something crazy like the government getting overthrown, which is not super common, but
or an extended civil war.
I feel like those usually fall on more ideological like lines.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's something that the administration or whomever that's running the country believes strongly in this and the populace doesn't, then you can see that happening. But with economical stuff, well, I mean, I guess it's on both sides of it. It is frightening, but also encouraging to see the people standing up and saying, no, you're not going to do this to us. You're not, because this is bad for everyone.
Yeah.
The continued deterioration of the economy in these parts of the world is bad for all of us.
Yeah, for sure. I think we can take that into our break. We're going to play a couple more tunes for you, and then we'll be back with international news. Hear what's up with that dubious L train. Stick with us.
Mis defectos. Tú sí sabes quererme, tú sí sabes adorarme, mi amor, no te vayas, quédate por siempre, para siempre, para siempre amarte. Corazón, tú sí sabes.
Tabaco, 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 papa, burrón. gente, el que niega, el creyente, sabio, necio, indiferente, tabaco, ron,
tabaco, tabaco, tabaco,
tabaco, ron,
tabaco, tabaco, pero tabaco,
tabaco, ron. Lleva, compadre, tu cruz y no se la des a nadie, y no se la des a nadie, y no se la des a nadie, que todos ya llevamos una cruz.
Welcome back to Objection to the Rule. You're listening live on Radio Free Brooklyn. And if you want to listen to us more when you're, say, not in front of your computer, you can download our free mobile app for iPhone or Android. It's right on the App Store for iPhone, and it's on Google Play if you're an Android kind of person. And you can also listen to back episodes on Podomatic.com or the Podomatic mobile app. Hear what we've been up to in previous weeks. So let's get into some local news. So we had a surprise announcement by Governor Cuomo this week that the long anticipated and long dreaded 15-month full shutdown of the L train is canceled, and the train is going to continue to run on nights and weekends. Magically, the train repairs will continue on the same schedule using tech that would allow it to keep running. And this came as a shock not only to New Yorkers, but also to the MTA and the New York City Department of Transportation, who were the ones planning this complete repair. So, woohoo! And also, what?
Yeah.
It's a relief for a lot of us, you know, at Radio Free Brooklyn, especially, you know, we're right in Bushwick on the L train, and it's sort of vital for us to get around. And we've been talking for a long time about what we're going to do. Now it seems like the conversation is going to shift back to the massive delays there will be because Cuomo is planning to...
With a lift? Like, why does MTA suck so bad? How did it... Okay, keep going. I'm sorry.
Yeah, whereas there are usually two tunnels, two tubes through which the L train moves, there will be one tube, and we can expect it will run slowly and with various issues. What's this going to look like? What do we think we're going to see? You know, should we rely on the L train? Should we continue with our alternate plans? I rode my bike here because the G train wasn't running, even though the L train was.
Right. I think, so back in the day, when I first moved to New York in 2007, right around the time that they were going to start opening the L train, it was like that. It was, you know, of course, new train lines always face these kinds of issues. So there were delays, there were signal issues, there was yada, yada, yada. And it was still manageable. People still wanted to come to Williamsburg. People still wanted to live in Williamsburg. People, you know, even tourists and traveling here. So I think that people may be a little bit more agitated while they're on the L train. But to be honest, in my experience, as soon as you get off of a train that had experienced major delays or anything like that, you immediately move on.
Right.
If they want to change the narrative, the tone of MTA that New Yorkers have, it's going to take a lot more. And if they want, and making it worse, I think shutting the L train down for a year and a half mm-hmm. makes it worse than dealing with an L train that may have technical issues yeah. or delays or things like that.
Right. Yeah.
They got to get these people. And they need the money.
Right.
I brought that up at the beginning. It was like 2 years ago when they started talking about this, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe more.
Yeah.
Maybe 3 years ago when they started talking about shutting down the L train. And I said right then and there, I was like, there is way too much development and purchasing of, you know, airspace for, right. for things like that out here in this part of Brooklyn, all along the L train line, where there are probably already billions of dollars invested mm-hmm. waiting for the opportunity to get these developments going.
Right.
For example, in our neighborhood where we are now, they can't build apartments until mm-hmm. until they rezone it. But they're waiting. There are investors who are sitting on this waiting for these opportunities. And so to shut down the L train for a year and a half, to shut down the existing development that's already been happening, the people who have moved out here, either purchased property or moved out here permanently, it would put a huge dent in the checkbooks of the developers. And yeah. that was why I said, I was like, I don't think it's going to happen. It won't happen.
Too much
it's
money
a long
in it.
Ways
yeah.
away. In fact, it was so out there. I honestly still think that there was something going on below the surface that we didn't see of people using
money
basically the
hands.
L line yeah. to like a game of chicken almost. Like, all right, we'll just shut it down. Watch. We'll print it in the, you know, in the New York Times tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It'll show up and everyone's going to freak out. And if you don't change your mind, we'll shut it down. It was kind of like this whole government shutdown
yeah.
thing where we're all like, the rest of us are like, wait, don't shut down the L train.
Yeah.
No, you can't do that. We need the L train. And we, wherever that pressure went,
right.
Which I don't really know where that
right,
pressure
where
went. I just knew it was
exactly.
there. But that
yeah.
pressure, I think, may have also been tied up into financial interest and trying to force someone's hand.
Yeah, because the other question is, where are they going to get the money for this? You know, where is the nearly bankrupt MTA going to get the money for this, you know, fancy new technology from Europe?
Well, Cuomo knows all the billionaires and trillionaires and cajillionaires, so.
Yeah, I mean, the other interesting part of this is there were a lot of conversations happening that were sort of adjacent to the shutdown about the future of the city and what it's going to look like, you know, because North Brooklyn, Bushwick and Williamsburg are in a lot of ways the newest and hottest parts, you
yeah.
know. They're where the new people, the new money, the new quote-unquote hipsters are going.
The new style,
you know?
Of New York. The
right.
new style.
Right.
The new face of New York City.
Right. And if those people can't live or won't live in this part of the city anymore, where are they going to go?
Yeah.
So, you know, people in South Brooklyn were talking with fear about, you know, are these people going to be moving into our communities, displacing us, you know,
mm-hmm.
displacing the culture, sort of pasting over the Bushwick Williamsburg scene. And it's interesting to see that switch a little bit,
yeah,
you know.
I'm thrilled. I mean, and to be honest, like, not only A, I'm here once a week.
Right.
B, I live like three blocks away from here. I mean, that helps. So the L train wouldn't have affected me getting here once a week, but it may have affected just me over the overall existence of Radio Free Brooklyn even existing
yeah.
in this neighborhood.
Yeah, you know, RFB yeah. would change a lot.
I work
right.
remotely, so that was going to help.
Mm-hmm.
I mostly work remotely, so at home, so I'm not using the L train again. But we have Airbnb,
mm-hmm.
and you shut down the L train. Nobody's going to want to stay in this
yeah.
part of New York City. How are they going to get anywhere? Even, I mean, they were saying maybe leave it open to Lorimer or something, but still,
yeah.
like it once it, like, we get mostly Europeans, and a little bit of like maybe some from Japan and,
mm-hmm.
and China and South Korea, but mostly Europeans and Great Britain. So we were terrified. We're like, okay, we worked really hard to develop this, and there are a lot of people
yeah,
in this neighborhood who have done that and rely on the L train for their, like, even like independently owned, like small businesses,
mm-hmm.
and when people are supplementing their income with, you know, whichever people who own these buildings, families own these buildings out here,
right.
who rely on the L train for people to want to live out here, to rent these spaces. And what we were afraid of, a lot of people were afraid of, is like, once the L train shuts down, nobody's going to want to stay here. Nobody's
right.
going to want to come to this part of New York City if they can't be in Manhattan in less than 20 minutes.
Right. And, you know, so I think for all these reasons that you've said, and, you know, some more, it's gotta happen. We need an L train. But the question is, how are we going to, if the MTA in New York City, NYDOT, were sort of blindsided by this Cuomo announcement, how's this going to happen? How are we going to get the train where it needs to be? Or is it just going to be, you know, the long-running joke of the MTA that doesn't run in the, you know, in one of the major international cities in the world?
I think it'll run. I don't believe the stories that we were fed and are still being fed. I just don't believe it. If we're smarter than that, and we know it's like, well, they worked for years on developing this, and then all of a sudden, like Cuomo's engineers mm-hmm. come marching up in there and be like, nope, we're canceling it. Right. We're going to do it this other, better way.
Right.
And they're like, how did you develop that so quickly? And they're like, well, the technology didn't exist before. How come when the technology became into existence, the MTA didn't know about it? Why doesn't the MTA know when this technology comes into existence? Why don't they know that?
Yeah.
How did they not know? Long enough for Cuomo's team to fully develop a separate plan. And wait a minute, where did his team get access to the institutional awareness and internal knowledge to be able to develop a plan
right.
for
it's
MTA?
It's one of those things where you lift the cover off and nothing makes sense.
Doesn't
it's
work.
Not
doesn't
even the same
up.
Machinery.
Cuomo, if you're listening, we need more answers.
Yeah.
We
give
need
us
them.
Answers, Cuomo. All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for listening to Objection to the Rule on Radio Free Brooklyn. We'll be back next week with more stories and news. You can stay tuned for What is Love with Sasha Sugar. And thanks for listening.
All right. See you, everyone.